Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
Darren Smith, Damon Bruce with you here on 95.7 The Game. The thing that you asked him about was the concept of a bell cow running back. Like, I'm going to need to explain what bell cow running backs are to the audience the same way I would need to explain what a phone book was, because they kind of went the way of the dodo right around the same time. Here's some really interesting numbers. I think you're going to find this fascinating. Going back all the way to 2000. So this is 19 years of data.
Way back.
Running backs in the NFL who had more than 15 rushing attempts in 10 or more games in any season. So in other words, you had at least 15 rushing attempts, 10 or more games in any season, which would suggest you're a bit of a bell cow back. We're going to you week in, week out to carry the load. In 2000, there were 16 running backs who qualified for at least 15 carries or more over the course of 10 games. In 2001, it dipped to 11. In 2002, it grew back to 15. And then I'm going to count from 2002 to 2018. And here are the number of running backs with at least 15 or more carries in 10-plus games. 15, 14, 12, 12, 17, peaking in 2006. 13, 12, 7, 10, 8, 11, 9. From 2014 to 2018, again, from 2014 when Jim Harbaugh was fired to today, 6, 3, 9, 4, and in last season there was one running back, one. Who was it, by the way?
Want to guess?
Who was the one?
I would guess it was Saquon Barkley.
Saquon, but you're probably
right. But I'm just guessing. I really don't know the answer to that.
You know what? I think that's probably as on the money a guess as we're going to get. Barkley, maybe Ezekiel Elliott, or was he suspended too often?
Right. I get my ears confused and the suspension's confused with Ezekiel Elliott.
Anyways.
Gurley would have been a good guess, though, because for a while, 8-10 games, he was on an MVP caliber type pace.
Sure was. The death of the bell cow running back is a real crisis in terms of, like, we have a species going extinct. The 49ers, specifically Kyle Shanahan, going back to Atlanta, is kind of at the forefront of this.
I would say that this is such a unique trend in the sport. And you go back to Saquon Barkley for a second, who I think was the number two overall pick two drafts ago. Does that sound right? He was second or third, somewhere in that range. I think he was the second overall pick. So number one was Baker Mayfield. Number two, I believe, was Saquon Barkley. And then I think it was Sam Darnold. And he won the NFL, Damon, Offensive Rookie of the Year.
Right.
Like, they don't give that to bad players, and yet on social media, if you're to believe what's said on social media, which is oftentimes nothing more than an echo chamber, the Giants general manager was a clueless buffoon who made a huge mistake drafting Saquon Barkley. And you think to yourself, well, how can this be? Because he's got numbers, and he's been productive, and he won the Rookie of the Year, the Offensive Rookie of the Year. Doesn't that validate that decision-making in some capacity? And the answer is no. Nobody wants to take their foot off the neck of the general manager. Dave Gettleman, I think is his name.
Yeah,
they continue to say he's just an nincompoop and just a total boob at his job. And you're like, okay, I mean, I guess if that's the way he's viewed in the NFL circles, who am I to argue that this has been a successful player?
At some point, results have to matter in a sports conversation, right?
I guess, but not in that case. Everybody just holds it against him that he passed up on Darnold or passed up on whomever else. may have come after him, despite that he was decorated and that he was an exciting player to watch.
Albie tells me in my ear that it was Ezekiel Elliott, by the way, last year, the one back who had at least 15 or more carries in 10 or more games. So death of the bell cow running back. Who will the Niners consider their number one guy? Again, McKinnon was the original Kyle Shanahan hand-picked Swiss Army knife that he wanted to install as his weapon X in year one. Obviously, that didn't happen. Well, year two, excuse me. That was his preferred offseason weapon X choice for year two. McKinnon misses all of 2018, but he's certainly being paid to be the guy. I still think that Tevin Coleman, who started 14 games last year, rushed for 800 yards with nearly 300 receiving yards, knows Shanahan's offense like on game day, not just knows it in practice, but knows it on game day going back to Atlanta. I think he's got – that might be the guy written all over him. Mm-hmm. And then there's Matt Breida, who when healthy – was as interesting and productive and versatile and scheme dynamic as I think your best hopes for both these guys. So this is part of the reason why people are getting excited about the 49ers, and got the USA Today saying that the Niners are going to be in the playoffs, winning their division, and they have the Rams out of the playoffs. USA Today, Nate Davis of USA Today predicts that the Niners are going to win the NFC West with a 10-6 record, and the Rams are going 9-7 and not even going to the playoffs. I mean, that's an awful lot of presumption, but Super Bowl hangovers are as real as bad teams turning it around to get good.
And we just said they spent a lot of money on Todd Gurley. Todd Gurley's not quite the same guy now. It's not just the injury which kept him out, and he was so limited even in the Super Bowl. And now you have to think maybe there's a little bit of carryover. There's a little bit of tendinitis associated with Gurley.
I even heard arthritis.
And whatever is going to linger. And he didn't play a single snap during the preseason last year. So, you know, that was purely in the regular season. I know Ndamukong Suh didn't have a great first three quarters of the season, but he turned it on in December, was a factor heading into the postseason. Listen, you want to climb out on a limb. I don't think you can go wrong saying that the Rams either will or won't make the playoffs. And they've won the division back-to-back years. It's hard to win it three straight years for as talented and as well-coached as they appear to be. They've lost a little bit. They lost their quarterback coach, who was the head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals. So there's a little bit of change now that they got to deal with for the first time under Sean McVay.
Built to regress a little.
Yeah, I would think that an Aqib Talib is not getting any younger. Marcus Peters, will he be on good behavior again? Was he even on good behavior last year?
He was to a point, and then it sours, yep. And then that's when the Rams started, not unraveling. You can't unravel and appear in the Super Bowl, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't think it's all that outrageous or hot take-ish to suggest or think that maybe the Rams take a step back. And remember, it's not like the prediction was 4-12. It was 9-7, which a lot of seasons will get you into the postseason. But I don't know that I'd climb way out on that limb with the Niners, but it's all there. It's all right in front of them, as Daniel Jeremiah and others have said for the last couple of weeks.
Hunter calling from Richmond. You're on 95.7 The Game. What's up?
Hey, guys. I just wanted a quick question. Who was the last team to win a Super Bowl with a top 10 running back in the league during that time? I'll take your answer off there. Thanks.
Last team to win a Super Bowl with a top 10 running, but top 10 of what? Yeah, top 10 yards, touchdowns, all time. I don't know. Like, just going back in my mind, you have to scratch off any Patriot champion, right? Let's eliminate you.
Right, because they distributed, as she said, they distributed so evenly. So the last couple of years, you wouldn't find a top 10 Patriot running back. I don't think you'd find a top 10 Eagles running back from the previous season either.
It's the Seattle Seahawks with Marshawn Lynch, isn't it?
It might be. Gosh, would you have to go back that far?
It doesn't even feel like we're going back that far, but that's officially now like 6, 7, 8 Super Bowls ago. That is going back a little bit far, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it was LeGarrette Blount?
No. I mean, no. LeGarrette Blount was not. He might have gotten more carries that day, but he was never the cast in the role all season long bell cow back who then carried you through the playoffs.
Right. Never Peterson, not McFadden.
Saw a story today that Adrian Peterson is broke. Made over $90 million in his career, on-field earnings, and is broke.
Crazy what happens to, because just crazy what happens to these athletes sometimes and who they trust.
It's staggering how often money and fame become a toxic mix to professional athletes. You would think that, hey, no matter where you started from, the day you signed that multi-million dollar contract, your problems start going away. More money, more problems.
More
we
money,
go back
problems.
To yesterday's show.
Yep, but they also become targets.
Totally.
A lot of these cases, they become big-time targets, too.
Absolutely. And look at how sophisticated con artists are just hustling Auntie May or your grandma out of her Social Security check. The predatory people around professional athletes gets ridiculous.
Did you see the 30 for 30? I think it was called
Broke,
wasn't
yes.
it? Oh, my gosh. The Andre Rison. Now, part of them was wistful for how they blew all of this money. Part of them was like, hell yeah, I would have parties every night with the most expensive champagne. They all had some sort of record company going, but they did an entire 30 for 30 on what happened to some of these guys.
Yeah, and it's all, look, I don't begrudge you. Throw some money around. Have a lot of fun. If part of your equation is, well, I'm going to be crazy over here, but my financial advisor is going to take care of it over here, and then your financial advisor is the biggest crook in the room, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
You're in a lot of trouble quickly. Damon, wasn't Corey Dillon the Patriots' top 10 back? God, yeah, but man, if we got to go back to Corey Dillon, I think that makes our point for us. Yeah. That's a good pull, though, by the way, Corey Dillon. Talk about a guy who got out of Cincinnati, kept on going,
mm-hmm.
finally got in good situation. Boy, situations dictate careers as much as anything. Situation tonight for the San Francisco Giants. How about this for the lineup? Buster Posey has been moved out of cleanup, which is something that Tim Flannery yesterday was talking about. Don't expect that to happen anytime soon.
He likes Buster Posey and honors Buster Posey more than he likes any of us. He respects Bumgarner more than he likes any of us because he let Bum hit when everybody didn't want him to hit. Even though he's 76 pitches into it, the bullpens needed a break. There was one out. There wasn't two out. I mean, there's some, but you can name all the reasons, but it was out of respect for the man. And that's why guys play for him.
Look, respect goes a long way, but production does matter when all of a sudden you're trying to be a good baseball team, which the Giants are trying to do this week at the very least. Buster Posey is now in the two-hole, Sandoval hitting third, Dickerson hits cleanup, followed by Crawford, Yastrzemski, Pilar, Panic, and Bumgarner. So a little tweak to the lineup. I wonder if that was Bruce making a decision or Farhan pulling a lever. 888-957-9570. Coming up next, we're going to talk about this Giants run with Alex Pavlovich, our insider. All of that is around the corner, and so is Elena. Hello!
Now, back to the Damon Bruce Show on 95.7 The Game.
Back here on 95.7 The Game, Darren Smith from San Diego riding shotgun again today. And there were a ton of weeks leading up to this interview right here where Albie would be like, you want to book Alex Pavlovich? And I'd be like, no, we really don't have anything to talk about. Now, all of a sudden, we got something to talk about with our friend Alex Pavlovich, 95.7 The Game Giants insider. You, of course, see him on NBC Sports Bay Area. All of our guests appear on the Dialpad guest line. Dialpad helps you make smarter calls. 16-3 in their last 19 games. Am I on peyote, or did that happen, Alex?
Well, first of all, if this happens again, I can just talk about the Niners or Warriors for 20 minutes if you want that. So you can still call me in May. But, yeah, I really don't. You know, I don't know whose show it was on. I don't. It was somebody with you guys, I think, about 3 weeks ago, and they asked me what would have to happen for these guys not to go into full sell mode. I think it was the morning show, and I jokingly said, I mean, I guess if they go like 18-2, then things might change, and they legitimately have almost done that. So that was not just knowledge. I mean, that wasn't anybody told me that. It just kind of was the way this was heading, and they really have changed a lot, and not just for this year, I think, but the outlook of the future in the last 3 weeks. And it's interesting. They're back in the race. They have put themselves in a bit of a weird spot because they do have the best trade chips on the market. But also, I think you look at what they did last night in the eighth inning, and I think it's hard to go into that clubhouse and tell those guys with the way they're playing and the way they're fighting every single night that we're going to pull the rug out from under you.
This is our first deadline together with Farhan, so we don't know what he is going to do. There's no track record to look back at and suggest, well, this could be it, this could be that. Do you have an inkling, one way or the other, Alex, if he's looking at this as a problem that he needs to solve or an opportunity he never really thought he was going to be offered here in year one?
No, I think he's probably looking at this as an opportunity. We don't know, like you said, and I've enjoyed the last 3 or 4 days as national reporters have tried to jump on top of this and try to figure out what the Giants are going to do, because I don't think anybody knows outside of his office. I think that's the honest truth, and this is his show. I think you can just go by what we know about him, and I'll say a couple things. I mean, first of all, he has thick skin. He wore this early on. He wore the Connor Joe and Michael Reed thing. He understood. If he feels like the best thing going forward is to trade a Bumgarner or trade a Smith to do anything, he's going to do it, and he's going to take the arrows, and he will try to explain his decision making process. But he's not going to worry about perception. The other thing, he does want to win. I mean, this isn't. He didn't come in here. He has never come in here and said this is a rebuild. And I think, you know, you've seen with the moves he's made that he understood that long term. They had a lot of work to do, but short term, maybe there's an opportunity here, and then maybe this roster, you know, had so many holes on it that he could try to fill them in a creative way, and he has done that with Dickerson and Yaz and Steven Vogt and Tyler Beatty, Sean Anderson. We've seen that from him, so I do think that he's going to view this opportunistically, and I think he is somebody who will never turn down an overwhelming deal if he gets it. But at the same time, I don't think he's afraid at all to go into September with this team and try to make a run. And if they lose a few prospects, they lose a few prospects, and he'll figure that out later.
Can you take us inside of the clubhouse? Because we all have our opinions from the outside, but you're around the players a lot. We've talked a little bit about Bumgarner using the term playoffs. Dickerson, he's talking about October baseball, panic last night. This was October baseball at Oracle. How much do you sense that they truly believe that this is a team that's built for October?
I think they do. And, you know, the thing is, like, another funny thing about the last few days has been, and no offense to people who haven't been there, but there's a lot of TV cameras descending upon this clubhouse now, and people are saying, what's the energy like? And is this different than it was 3 weeks ago? It really isn't. I mean, this clubhouse has been confident since the beginning. I mean, you would talk to guys in April and May, and they were hitting 200, and they would say, no, I'm better than this. I'm better than this. And it was tempting at times to be like, are you really better than this? I don't know that this team is better than this. But these guys were confident all along. And, the one thing they did early, even when they were playing terrible baseball, they would fall behind just about every night, 3-4-0. And just about every night in the eighth and ninth inning, there they were making a charge and at least getting the other closer into the game, at least getting the tying run to the plate. They would lose those games, but I think this is a group that had belief even going back to spring training. And it seemed crazy at times, but now they are a little bit validated, and I think they're taking that and running with it.
Alex Pavlovich, forgetting Bumgarner for a second, is Will Smith a Giant on August 1st?
I don't think so. I think, you still have to be a little bit realistic about where they're at and the fact that there are so many teams in this race with them for two wild card spots. And ultimately, you're putting yourself in a winner-take-all game, and once you do that, you're trying to get past the Dodgers. I know they match up well against the Dodgers, but still, that's a tough task in the postseason. So I think they have to be realistic, too. So I do think if there's a trade, it's going to be from that bullpen. And one thing we saw last night, Will's been outstanding. He's been really, really good. But that you can kind of figure that out a little bit if you have the right pieces. And Sam Dyson's been really good, too. So, you know, they could figure out the ninth. I think it's going to be more of torture. It's going to be hairier, but I think if they got a really good offer for somebody like Will Smith or Sam Dyson or both of them, they could piece together the back end of games. It'll be a blow, and it might ultimately end up costing them if they finish a game or two out, but I do think that that's maybe the opportunity they'll take.
Alex, it feels like an awful lot of this turnaround has come from the kids. Dickerson, Yaz, an awful lot of youthful contributions night in, night out. You got a veteran that you're going to pick to start clicking the rest of the way here? I mean, I'm still waiting to see the come around from Crawford, the come around. I mean, more than one game in Colorado anyways. I want to see Crawford come back to the mean a little bit, Posey a little bit more pop, Belt a little more something. Any expectation of any of those guys showing up this year?
Yeah, you know, Crawford and Posey the last couple of weeks, I think we've seen signs. And then Crawford's the one guy who we saw last year. I mean, the overall numbers weren't great, but he can get really hot for about a month and just become a really difficult out. And he's done that before, and he did that last year. And he's
great at-bat the other night. Phenomenal at-bat the other night out of him.
Yeah, yeah, he's done that. So I think that would be the best bet. And then, Brandon Belt has been hampered by that knee injury, and I think he's had some physical issues this year. But he still has good plate appearances, and the one thing we haven't really seen from him this year is that stretch where he's done this every single year where he'll hit four homers in five games, five homers in a week. So we haven't seen that. So, that to me is something that potentially could bubble up here in the next couple months and then help him get through a rough stretch. Because there's going to be downtimes for these other guys too.
Speaking of injuries, prognosis on Longoria, do they have any sense of when he might return? And also you see workout videos of Cueto. What are they thinking with regards to those two?
Yeah, Johnny's actually facing hitters this week in YBP, and then he's going to pitch in a rookie league game the first week of August. They're still mapping out his schedule, but everything's gone really well. And all along, they've been kind of aiming at September 1st, and I think right before that or right after that, they're going to get him back and see what they have there. And, it is interesting now because it's a little bit of a different situation. You can't really let this guy figure it out at the big league level anymore, but I think Johnny is so creative and just such a genius on the mound that I think they'll be okay in that respect. With Longoria, it's a little bit different. He was out there yesterday doing some baseball work, but there's no timetable. And really, one thing he told us, the only thing they really told us when he got hurt was that, this is going to be more than 2 weeks, hopefully not more than a month. So I think we're probably looking at the back end of August with him.
You have $10 to make this bet. You betting on Bumgarner's last game tonight, yes or no, $10?
I'm going to say no. I think that's the one thing that has changed in the last couple of weeks. And his situation is different than the other guys because the worst case with Bumgarner is you keep him and you put the qualifying offer on him. And he is worthy of the qualifying offer. It's hard to do that with a reliever because it's, $18, $19 million
right
for the year if they accept it. And he wouldn't stay for 1 year. I mean, he has earned the right to get his big payday. But I do think that has to play into the math here. Because you can get that compensation draft pick, and it sucks for him, but you also lower his price a little bit probably in the offseason if you want to have a reunion.
It took till mid-July to get here, but baseball season has finally arrived. Thank you very much, Alex. Great to talk to you, and I'm sure we'll be checking back in next week when we have a little bit more clarity here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Just in time for training camp, right? They're going to pick up here and just make it really interesting.
Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang.
Hey, he's at training camp, not me. Alex Pavlovich, 95.7 The Game. Always good to check in with him. And again, we got reasons to check in because all of a sudden we got baseball in the city of San Francisco that feels like it matters. Might not actually matter, but it feels like it matters. And I'll take that as much as you can sell it to me. Darren Smith along for the ride today. And there is one thing on a relatively fun, beautiful Tuesday afternoon that we have to tell you about that officially comes to us from the sad department of the world of sports. I want to play for you some sound from a fight. When did this fight occur?
It was over the weekend.
Over the weekend. Friday.
A smaller fight. Yeah.
Friday night, a fight you probably weren't paying much attention to, if any attention to it at all. This is boxing trainer Buddy McGirt talking to his fighter, whose name is Maxim Dadashev.
I'm going to stop the fight. Max, I'm going to stop it. Max, you're getting hit too much. You're getting hit too much, Max. Please, Max, please, let me do this, okay? Okay? Look at me. Please. Please, you're getting hit too much, Max. If I don't, they're going to do it. You understand me? If I don't, the referee's going to do it. Please. Please, Max. Come on, Max, please. Come on, you got to be honest with me, Max.
Hey, Max,
Max, you stop it, Doc. That's it. That's it.
Buddy McGirt threw in the towel for his fighter. Unfortunately, he didn't do it soon enough. The news today is that Dadashev died this morning as results of brain injuries suffered during an 11th round knockout loss. The other fighter, his name is Sabriel Matisse. Obviously, boxing doesn't enjoy the status that it used to in our country, but something like this, it brings it back to the headlines because, you know, we talk about brain injuries, and that's exactly what this man suffered. He was separated from, basically, his brain was separated from his own brain stem, essentially, here. He had bleeding on the brain. It was, it's very sad, very tragic. And I know that the victim here, and you can't help but have an incredible amount of compassion, Darren, for the family Dadashev, the team Dadashev. Mother, father, children, I don't know. He was 28 years old. It may sound odd to some, but my sympathy also is going to the fighter who did this. I mean, can you imagine being Sabriel Matisse? All you were was doing your job. You've stepped into the ring 100 times, stepped out of the ring 100 times, no worse for the wear. And then the one time you go ply your trade, a man dies. And this is not the taxicab scene from Pulp Fiction. This is real.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to unpack with this situation. Because as you said, first and foremost, you think about the person's family. You think about Max's family. I'm just going to go with Max for the name for this. You think about the trainer. Because for how long did his trainer, Buddy McGirt, for how long was he thinking that, but also understanding that this is the nature of the sport, which is often brutal? How long was he thinking that? How long is he going to live with the guilt of, man, I should have done something a little bit earlier? Or is he just going to chalk it up to the nature of the sport? You mentioned the fighter. How about the referee? Because as Buddy McGirt says there, if I don't stop it, the referee's going to stop it, Max. Now the referee has to think for the rest of his life, even though, again, it's part of the assumed risk with the sport, part of it, not every single fight, but now the referee has to think, man, did I do that the right way?
Right.
Did I do that right?
Right. Instead of calling it a round to go, I let it go on a round too long. You never know what punch is the punch that did the catastrophic damage. It's probably a totality of all the night's punishment. But, man, you cannot... You can't help but just feel for everyone in that situation, starting with the family of the man who passed away, but then all the people who live through that moment and have to go on in this profession tomorrow. That's tragic. And I'll tell you this, when you see this video, I know that you can only hear it. I'm going to play a portion of it for you again.
I'm going to stop the fight. Max, I'm going to stop it. Max, you're getting hit too much. You're getting hit too much, Max. Please, Max, please.
I mean, Damon, he's literally dying. He's dying, and he's trying to talk to his trainer about, please don't stop this. The trainer's pleading with him as the fighter's dying to go back into the ring, literally and figuratively.
And there is an absence in the fighter's eyes. You can tell he's there physically, but he is slowly separating from reality, from mental capacity, and I guess not too far out of the ring is when he initially collapsed, and he's been hospitalized ever since, and this morning he passed away. I am one who still prefers boxing, Darren, over UFC-style fighting. I've never been a fan of mixed martial arts. I understand that there's an incredible amount of skill and technique, but to me, when a fight is about submission holes, it turns into two dudes rolling around, and it looks like they're trying to fart on each other's head.
Right, yeah. Like, there's a lot of that
as
well.
Yeah, the pursuit of submission holds, to me, is not a great fight. The action that you see in this division, by the way, this guy comes to us from the this is the middleweight, lightweight?
This was a
140-pound world title elimination fight.
Right, which you know, actually leads to more of these types of situations than one might think on the surface, because you would think heavyweights, this would be more common with heavyweights, but these guys, they punch so quickly, and they take so many punches that the accumulation of said punches and the gloves are so light at this level, that's really what does in a lot of the lower classes, some of the lesser classes of fights other than the heavyweight division.
ESPN story says that the fight was grueling and Matias dominated. He landed numerous powerful blows to the head and body. Matias was ahead 109-100 on one judge's card, 108-101 on another judge. Another judge had it a little bit closer, but still a wide margin, scoring a fight five rounds, 107-102. So there was punishment being doled out, and, you know, Buddy McGirt made the right call, but obviously didn't do it soon enough. And, man, that's just, you know, and look, text line saying, you know, knockouts need to be called earlier. Some of the greatest fights I've ever seen have been won by fighters who were clearly out on their feet.
Oh, sure.
And they snap back to it. I mean, it's
a guy who's been knocked down, who's been bloodied, and he figures out a way. Did you ever see the documentary on I believe it was the Thrill in Manila. I know it was one of the Ali Frazier fights. Did you ever see the documentary where they show that fight to Joe Frazier? So they're with Joe Frazier in a room, and they're putting the fight on DVD or VCR, whatever it was. And they're watching the fight with Frazier while Frazier's going through it, what he's thinking in real time. Did you ever see that? Because Frazier says something that I always remembered.
I've seen so many Ali documentaries, so I don't know if this was a Frazier doc or specifically. Yeah. But what did he say?
But he said, like, I was willing to die in the ring. I was willing to die in the ring. And you know, there's part of me that sits and goes, you know, I respect that. You know, this is a unique risk to this sport. We all take risks in life. You took a risk by getting in your car, but that's not the same thing as this. This is a risk. Every single time that you step into the ring, there's something physically that is going to be taken from you in some capacity. And Frazier said, I was willing to die in the ring that night against Ali. And you go, wow, okay. I sort of respect that. And I also think that's completely insane. I think it's completely insane. I respect the gladiator attitude. I respect what he's willing to do. And he said that even in a much lesser state later on in his life than he would have in real time. It's not something he said with false bravado in a post-match press conference. He said that while watching, like, I was willing to die in the ring that night. And you kind of go, a piece of me understands and respects, and a piece of me thinks that you're completely insane.
There was grainy footage of a crash at Indianapolis, and the driver, you know, was killed in a fireball wreck instantly. And this was in the, I mean, pardon me, I do not know the year, 60s, 70s, before this turned into high-definition household entertainment, or there was really a way to cover an on-track tragedy. And I've seen the footage of this. Like, the guy is, you know, he just got disintegrated in an Indy car on the track of Indy, and they pivot right to the guy's wife or mother, and you can read her lips, mm-hmm. and she's just simply going, that's the way he would have wanted to go. That's the way he would have wanted to go out. I mean, it's just amazing the willingness to lay down and die in some of these sports that literally laying down and dying is part of that night's equation.
It is. And even his wife said, our son will continue to be raised like a great man like his father. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means that the son is going to be pushed into a boxing ring or encouraged, if that's the path that he wants to follow. But that is his wife who understands. You think about what sort of commitment you have from a spouse for somebody who is involved in this career, in this sport, and what that must be like knowing that this is what he does. This is the risk that he's willing to take every single time he steps into one of those rings.
Jonathan in San Francisco, you're on 95.7 The Game.
Hey, thank you, Damo, for this boxing talk. I just want to say, man, I hope I've seen the last of Manny Pacquiao. I mean, his greatness is truly evident in he's almost going to be 41, man. I don't want him taking any more punishment. And thanks for this boxing talk, because it really puts a light on, you know, what kind of sacrifices this man are putting out there just for our entertainment. And I just hope I've seen the last of him. It's not because he can't do it. Obviously, he could still do it, but it's not going to be worth no money if you're going to be a vegetable.
Jonathan, the worst thing that maybe could have happened to Pacquiao is that he won his last fight, which he did.
His 71st fight, by the way. Think about that. 71 times Manny Pacquiao has stepped into the ring.
It's an awful lot of fighting. And there's 71 times he stepped into the ring. How many other fights has he been in his life? How many times has he been in the ring sparring without headgear? I mean, There is a staggeringly good documentary on HBO. It was actually produced by LeBron and Maverick Carter about Ali. And it's My Name is Muhammad Ali is the name of it. And you could see how Team Ali in the late 70s, early 80s was pushing a fighter of diminished mental capacity into the ring with the fighter, of course, allowing it to happen because that's all the fighter knows. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that Manny Pacquiao, who even enjoys status as a Filipino senator, governor, wherever he is in the Philippines, elected official, that there's no doubt that the powers that be in this sport will take advantage of him the way that they chewed up and spit Ali out if he doesn't watch out for himself. Boxing doesn't do an awful lot for its fighters other than push them back into bad situations as long as they mean box office.
$75,000 was the purse for this event, which, again, I know it's easy to just toss that out there right now and say, was that really, really worth it? But that's not the way these guys are wired. And you can't say, I don't think that they step into the ring, Damon, thinking like, I could die today. But you must know if you're involved in this sport that this is the reality of it, unfortunately.
This is the life you have chosen. 888-957-9570. Your call's on this right around the corner. Looking forward to talking to you on that. And boy, we're really looking forward to 4 o'clock when we get to talk to the son of a baseball player to me that just personified baseball romance, Tony Gwynn Jr. Hell of a center fielder in his own right, defensively, could pick it from anywhere. Tony Gwynn Jr., who knows Darren very, very well, is going to join us to talk about what is coming up for the Giants when they head down to San Diego at the end of this Cubs series. So stick around. Much more on the way, courtesy of Fremont Bank, full-service banking, no compromises.
Now back to the Damon Bruce Show on 95.7 The Game.
Hey, we got good summer baseball for the first time. Again, the A's got mollywopped down in Houston yesterday. Hopefully they get back to their mojo tonight.
Mollywopped?
Mollywopped.
Mollywopped, yeah.
They got beaten badly.
Homer Bailey lived up to the name? Homer?
Yes. We've got the Giants. We'll see if they can keep a good thing going tonight against the Chicago Cubs. Madison Bumgarner, is this his final start in a Giants uniform this time? It might actually be. So we will all find out together. I'm looking forward to going down to the ballpark tonight. I know that's where Darren and I are going after the show. We're bringing Albie with us. It's going to be a good time. Elena, you want to roll? You make it with us? You working tonight? What do you got?
I love you, but I can't.
I love you, too, and I wish you could. Another time, then.
Definitely.
I know how much you like it, the baseball.
I do.
Yes.
I like how she just left the two. She's so mysterious. Just, I can't.
Yeah, no, very, no. This is an international woman of mystery over there.
I can't.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's going to tell you what you need to know, and what you need to know is she can't.
She can't.
Why? You don't need to know that.
No follow-ups.
You just need to know that can't happen. look, we were just talking about the tragic passing of a fighter who died due to injuries suffered in ring. And we were in the commercial break, Darren, and we were talking about how the NFL has really dodged this bullet for so long. And I'm wondering, is it not an, you know, they say the big one, the earthquake, it's not an if, but when? I know that they tried to make the game safer, but it's one person being hit the wrong way, landing the wrong way to be suffered from, separated from their spinal column. I mean, it's amazing that we don't see more truly catastrophic, if not even all the way to mortal injuries on a football field.
And think of how often we see the bad bone break in the lower leg, or we see the dislocated shoulder, or whatever it is that we see. And think about the image. Think about Theismann. You've seen that a million times in your life. That was Monday Night Football. Think about Alex Smith, unfortunately.
Right.
Now, that wasn't a nationally televised game, but we have those images. And the image of a player, if it ever comes, I hope we don't ever see it, but I'm with you. I sort of feel like the NFL is sadly a bit overdue for something like that. Maybe that's part of the heavy-handedness of taking out the lowering of the helmet and all the safety requirements and rules in place that they've started here over the last couple of years. I mean, that has to be a part of it because the NFL had to feel like, geez, look at our players, especially when they're done playing. It's just a matter of time before something's going to happen out there on a football field that's going to be to that level of catastrophe where somebody's going to die on a nationally televised game.
It's kind of amazing that it really hasn't already happened in our lifetime. I mean, I'm going on 44 right. years here, and there have been horrific injuries, and I've seen guys paralyzed.
Dennis Byrd is a name that comes to mind. We've had others as well. I mean, we saw just a couple of years ago with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Why am I drawing a blank? Shazier.
Yeah, Ryan Shazier.
That was a nationally televised game, and that was rough to watch, especially when you watched it back on replay a time or two, because it's almost like you could see his back break.
Right.
It's almost like you could see it pop right there, and then he immediately grabs for it. Thankfully, he's turning into a success story, even in a post-playing career. But I'm with you. Every time I watch one of these games and you see one of these hits, I think to myself, man, I feel fortunate that we're not watching that type of situation here play out during a football game.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what Monday's show would sound like if that happened. How the world would react. It would be, how about this? We don't know how to react to anything without overreacting to anything. And I'm not saying that it wouldn't be a huge moment to give the world pause, but what would the ramifications truly be? I don't know. What's amazing is I read another article today about how even though football has gone through a cycle of negative publicity over the last 10 years or so with the threat of CTE and all the damage that could be done, that there are more colleges adding football programs than there are colleges stepping away from football programs.
Huh.
Not big schools, little schools, Division III, Division II schools, Iowa, but you would think that the negative publicity the sport has received would cool off anyone whose Jets were, well, in 2015, we started a football team based on what we now know. It feels like no one would do that. It's just, you know, it's tradition that keeps us coming back, and you would not start this tradition now. No, teams are still going out there. Schools are still going out there, and they're starting this. It's because the interest and the profits and the people it brings back to campus. It does more than anything else. There is no greater fundraising your school could have other than kickoff homecoming 1 o'clock.
Well, we've seen where I live, there's been a couple of high school games that have been canceled just due to lack of participation. And that was always going to be a byproduct of a generation of moms, parents being worried about having their son play that sport when we've heard all the negative news, as you just said. So I would ask you now, as you are literally days away, weeks away.
Soon.
You very well. I do love the fact that you and Jillian have gone old school here, that it's a total mystery what the gender of your soon-to-be-born child is. Have you talked about this? Have you thought about this at all in your life here? If you have a little boy come out, a little boy wants to play football, what are you guys going to do?
I like the name Jack an awful lot. I think Jack Bruce sounds like a kid who just crushes quarterbacks. Of course, if my child wants to play football, my child's playing football. Period. End of story.
Period.
I have zero worry that anything could happen beyond like what normally happens to kids who play football, which the overwhelming amount of evidence for kids who play football topping out senior year of high school varsity, they're fine. The overwhelming majority who have ever stepped in a football huddle today are fine. Fine and dandy. No worse for the wear. Glad that I did it. Learned a lot about myself, my friends, my teammates. I think that there are so many lessons of teamwork in football. It's a wonderful avenue to walk down and through. Where I get concerned is, are you so good that you're now a full scholarship athlete? Now we're really upping the damage done on a daily basis. To me, football, even though there are several examples of bad things happening in high school, it doesn't really become scary until you're on the edge of professionalism. College football, and then obviously, if you are going into the NFL, you know what you're signing up for.
So, well, you hope, and that wasn't always the case, though. And I think that that's the issue that I and a lot of other people have with the league, is that they did hide a lot of this information from the players, which is why there are lawsuits, multiple lawsuits here from former players towards the league, and that they weren't informed not only of the risk, but of their own diagnosis. But just going back to you as a parent here, I know Drew Brees and others have suggested, just Drew Brees because he's the most famous name that I can think of off the top of my head. What about if we took contact out of it until high school and flag football until your ninth grade?
Not a bad idea at all, really. I also strongly suggest that your son or daughter never tries to throw a curveball until they're at least 16, 18 years old.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there are definitely age groups where you can back off the physicality and just have fun and enjoy the sport. And really, considering the amount of concentration and burnout quotient that you read about now, less is more at an early age. I'm convinced of that. I know that you do not have an in utero child, but I have to ask you about a fictitious child. Would you hesitate? You played football in high school, yes?
No, not in high school. I played football, but I was never part of an organized team through high school.
I would pick up backyard football.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have any issue if you decided that up until the high school ages that you wanted to play flag. I think that that's a reasonable compromise. I don't feel like that's any sort of negative statement on where America, because you hear that all the time about the wussification or whatever. I wouldn't feel that way. I think that that's reasonable. I don't think anybody would accuse Drew Brees and others of being part of that conspiracy. I would want my child to play a sport that made him or her happy. I would probably steer them or encourage them in other areas other than football. But I also think we're a lot smarter in 2019 than we were even 10 years ago. So I would feel comfortable about the level of protection and the level of education with the coaching staff, et cetera. You know, where I worry about with football, though, is you see even at the NFL level, which is the most expensive league on the planet, and they have these independent neurologists, and they miss. And they miss players who are dealing with concussion-related symptoms, which is a concussion, by the way. And then you start thinking about at the collegiate level, and you think about at the high school level, are the people who are there, like that still to me is a big question. Are the people who are there who are responsible for the players, are they good enough to be able to diagnose what's actually happening in real time? And I think that football still is in a little bit of I don't want to say trouble, but I still think that there are some questions about its future, because at what point does something happen at the collegiate level and then a state school is responsible financially or a high school is responsible financially for something that's misdiagnosed? So you wonder about insurance premiums, things of that nature, and that all gets factored in. I think we're getting better at it. I do. I think we're getting a lot better at it. It's probably never been safer than it is today to play football, but it's still, you know, there's always going to be those concerns, I'm sure, for parents.
Look, people love to pile on when they see a pile to pile on. And football was a pile on because it was very in vogue to not like the sport for several reasons. Societally, culturally, physically, CTE standpoint. If you're a believer in the realities of math and statistics and odds, like, let's go ahead and just be completely honest that driving your daughter to soccer practice her life is in more jeopardy than your son is in the fourth quarter of any football game. Mathematically, you have a better chance to be involved in a car accident on the way to soccer practice than you do have of being involved in you have to go to the hospital now, that's how bad you got hurt in a football game. That's the truth. But you never hear anyone talk about how dangerous it is to drive your daughter to soccer practice, because that's not going to lead ESPN. That's not going to get clicks. That's not the reality that people want to hear. People would rather pretend that football is lopping the heads off of children almost by, you know, on a volunteer basis.
Well, it's not like there's not data that supports some of that. And there is data that supports some of
that. Right, it's dangerous, but we all knew that going in.
Well, again, but I also think that it's just misleading an entire generation of your workforce into believing that they were at no risk whatsoever, or that they weren't even doing any damage to themselves, and they better get out there. And, hey, how many fingers am I holding up? Good enough.
Tuesday.
Yeah, go get back out there.
By the way, it is Tuesday. More specifically, it's 4 o'clock on a Tuesday.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.